We began our study this week reading from the first chapter of the Bible. We're going to end our time together this week reading from the last two chapters of the Bible. Not the entirety of these two chapters, but a good portion of both. And this reading is going to be a familiar text to you. You have read sections concerning and probably the whole of this account at times of John's picture, what was revelation was given to him by Jesus Christ concerning the city that God has prepared for his people, the city that has foundations, the city of heaven, the city of God. And I'm going to read that text together tonight, but I want you to listen carefully to the reading. Listen carefully to the description. I want you to picture what we read here in your mind's eye. I want you to soak in what John writes for us, because folks, this is our home. This is our destiny, what we read of here. And it is good for us as pilgrims to dream about where we're going, to see the horizon, to see the city that's set on a hill whose builder and maker is God, to dream about it, to reflect on it. And so I want you to do that as we read together tonight, beginning in verse 1 of Revelation 21. John writes the following: "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he shall dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be among them. And he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death, there shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. And he said, Write, for these words are faithful and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He who overcomes shall inherit these things. And I will be his God, and he will be my son. But for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, Come here, and I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And so he carried me away in the spirit to a great and a high mountain, and he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and a high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are those of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, and 3 on the north, and 3 on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of that city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And the one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall. The city's laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its width. And he measured the city with a rod, 1,500 miles. Its length and width and height are equal. And he measured its wall, 72 yards, according to human measurements, which are also angelic ones. And the material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold like clear glass. The foundation stones of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second, sapphire, the third, chalcedony, the fourth, emerald, the fifth, sardonyx, the sixth, sardius, the seventh, chrysolite, the eighth, beryl, the ninth, topaz, the tenth, chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th was amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each one of the gates was a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. I saw no temple in it. For the Lord God the Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And the nations shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it, and in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed. And they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it, and nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. And he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb, in the middle of the street. And on either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall no longer be any curse, and the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his bondservants shall serve him. And they shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. And there shall no longer be any night. They shall not have need of the light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever. The Bible is unique among books for a number of reasons. But one of the unique features of the Bible is the way that it opens and the way that it closes. The Bible is unique among books because it not only opens with the beginning, the Bible ends with the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Moses writes, Genesis 1, verse 1. There was no mortal who was living that was an eyewitness to that beginning. Man was not created until the sixth day. Though that was the beginning of the mortal adventure, the one that we've all been a part of since that time. But there's another beginning, a new beginning, that in the wisdom of God necessarily follows the first. Revelation 21, verse 5, John writes, "Behold, I am making all things new," came the declaration from the throne. And so ends the revelation of God with that statement, "I am making all things new." Or we might better say, "So it begins." And what we read of here in Revelation 21 is another creation story. But this is one that doesn't end. This is an adventure that is immortal. And though no eye was there to see the first beginning, every eye will see as God makes all things new. And what a beginning it will be. John saw it first, and what he has by inspiration is faithfully recorded it down so that we might, our appetites might be whetted and our spirits might be stirred, so that we anticipate the end of the present order, which is the beginning of the new order. And so the Bible opens with a beginning, and it ends with a beginning. And could I add that the best is yet to begin? I mean, the best things that you've ever dreamed about, that you've ever thought about, that you've ever anticipated, are yet to begin, according to this record. There are so many things I'd like to know about the new heavens and the new earth that aren't described. I'd like to know what it feels like. I'd like to know what it really is like. I know that the language that's found here in Revelation 21 and 22 is imagery to some extent. It borrows from what is our experience here and what is the nature of this material world, in order to communicate to us the value and the reality and the concreteness and the significance and the intimacy and the character of that world. But I'd really like to know what the metaphysical quality of it. I mean, what's the real makeup? What is it like? And there's so many things I'd like to know about that, about its difference and its likeness to this present order, that just aren't answered for us here in the text. I do know that Peter writes concerning the new creation in 2 Peter 3, verse 13, that in the new creation, in the new heavens and the new earth, it is a place in which righteousness dwells. I love that statement. It is a place in which righteousness dwells. That will be the prevailing quality of the new creation. It is a place where righteousness reigns, where God's right ways are never thwarted, where God's right ways are never in any way, have any sort of shadow that interrupts them in any kind of way. There is no forbidden tree in this creation. There is no deceptive serpent. There are no thorns and thistles. They are extinct. There is no more sweaty brows. There is no more laboring by the sweat of your brow to make bread. You see, righteousness in the new creation is here to stay. Wickedness has had her day in this land. Righteousness will be there to dwell. And while there are so many things I'd like to know about the new heavens and the new earth, a part of even the joy of this world, is it not, is the joy of discovery, of seeing some new region for the first time, of experiencing some new vista, of meeting new people, of learning some new truth, or seeing some old truth in a new way. That's part of one of the joys, at least for me, in this world, is the joy of discovery. And I expect that one of the joys of that world will be the joy of discovery. All the things that God has been storing up for His people when they finally will dwell in His presence and when they will see Him face to face and when they will really know and experience all these blessings that we experience now by faith and in hope and in anticipation. When we really do, when we really are lavished with them and are sitting in the midst of them, discovery will go to a whole new level when God's blessings are unfolding before our view and in His presence. It's the city, though, that John focuses our attention on. He moves past just the new creation and he focuses on the city. And this, brothers and sisters, is some city. It's a city unlike any city that you've ever thought about, ever dreamed about. You know, in the first creation, God planted the garden where He dwelt with man. But it's as if God has taken, and now at the end of His revelation to us, it's as if God has taken all of the raw materials that were there in the Garden of Eden, and He is now fashioned together into a civilization. You see, we saw the beginning of the plan, now we see the end of the plan, and everything has come together into this lavish city, this city that God has built, this holy city, this new Jerusalem. But it is not just a city, it is so much more than a city, because as John begins to describe it, we see that it's a city that is a garden too. But it's more than a city that's a garden, it's a city that is a garden, that is a bride, that is a tabernacle, that is a mountain, that is a family, that is a kingdom that stands forever. It's all of those things rolled up into one. Every wonderful picture that God has used throughout the course of the biblical revelation to communicate to mankind the kind of relationship, the kind of trust relationship that God wants with man, all of those wonderful pictures come together into this beautiful picture of the city that we see here in Revelation 21 and 22. And so the Garden of Eden, where there was the Tree of Life, where there was a river that flowed through the garden and watered the garden, where there was the lavish splendor of God's abundance that supplied Adam and Eve in the garden where they tended it, and where God walked with them in the cool of the day. Here, that the garden that was lost, that paradise is now regained. But it's not just a garden. It is also a garden that's a bride. And so John sees the city coming, descending from heaven. He says it's like a bride adorned for her husband. Israel was Jehovah's bride in the Old Covenant. Some of the prophets use that language to talk about God's relationship with Israel, as if God had married Israel. And that when she worshipped idols, she was an adulteress, God accused her of being. And so He sent her away into captivity and then He took her back again. And we read about in the New Testament how we are, the people of God, are the bride of Christ. It communicates something about Christ's love for us. We talked about that when we talked about marriage in Ephesians 5 on Monday of this week. That there is this husband-wife relationship that we as the bride of Christ have with Him. And what we have here in Revelation is the perfection of the bride. We have here we have the wedding procession when now there will be complete communion between the people of God and Jesus in a way that is unfettered. But she's the bride, the city that is a garden that is a bride that's also a tabernacle. God dwelt with His people in a tent when they came out of the land of Egypt. He had a special tent built right at Sinai just so that He could camp among them and be with them in an intimate way. And yet there was at the same time, though God was in a tent in the midst of Israel, He was still separated from them because they couldn't just walk into God's tent and see Him. Since the day of Pentecost, we've had a more intimate relationship with God because God says that we are His tabernacle, we are His temple, and so that God dwells with us in a more intimate fashion than He even did with Israel when they were in the wilderness. But here there is no tabernacle. God and the Lamb are the tabernacle. You see, the people are with them in an intimate way. We see Him. We are in His presence. And so we don't just believe that He's there in our hearts. We don't just take the evidence for that we have by faith. There is this experiential knowledge of actually being in the presence of God. So it's the city that is a garden, that is a bride, that is a tabernacle. It's a tabernacle that is a mountain. He talks about how high this city is. Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 2, talks about how the mountain of the house of the Lord would be raised up as the chief of the hills. And when we come to this city, this mountain city, this mountain fortress, we will see that the kingdom of God is the only kingdom that has ever been. That even our nation, with all of its virtues and with all of its greatness, is nothing in comparison to God's kingdom. That this is the mountain that is raised up over all mountains. That it is God's authority that is supreme, that has reigned. It is God's power that has ruled over all of wickedness, that has been victorious and that has been supreme. And so Mount Zion will loom larger and loftier than we've ever imagined before. But it's not just a mountain, it's also a family. We are called sons in this city. There are words that are very special, and so many special words are such small words. Son is just a three-letter word. It's just a little word. But son means so much, does it not? It communicates relationship. It communicates intimacy. And never will the term son spark such a thrill in a man's heart than when God says, "My son, my daughter," when He welcomes us into His presence. And we know that we're family. We know that we belong with Him. And it's a family, we're told, that is a kingdom. What is remarkable about this city is that the citizens here are described as being bondservants, it says in verse 3 of chapter 2. His bondservants shall serve Him. And yet they also enjoy some rain. So that in verse 5 of chapter 22, it says, "The Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever." Who ever heard of servants that are also kings? Who ever heard of citizens that are servants, but that at the same time are a part of the royal family in the city? That's why I said this is a different kind of city. The kings of the earth, we're told, shall bring their glory into the royal city. Chapter 21 and verse 24, His bondservants shall reign with Him. The text we just read in chapter 22 and verse 5. But you see, it's in the city of God. It's in the kingdom of God that the least is the greatest. That's why citizens can also be kings. It's in the kingdom of God that the servant wears a crown. And it's in the city of God that the servant of servants, the least of all, Jesus Himself, will reign as King of Kings. And it's the people around Him who've learned to have that same kind of servant heart who reign together in this royal family, in this royal city that is a garden, that is a bride, that is a tabernacle, that is a mountain, that's a family, that's a kingdom. You know, cities are the height of human civilization. It's in cities that man performs so many of his great feats. It's in cities that man fulfills his charge to subdue the earth, is it not? I mean, that's where we really see the demonstration of that. Cities are the height of human cooperation. Cities are the ultimate expression and sustainer of human ingenuity. But you know what's happened to every city that we've built? Doesn't matter what city you're talking about. Every city that man built has gone the way of Babel, the first city. And so rather than subduing the world, what we become in our cities are the slaves of worldliness. And rather than cooperating together in righteousness, what happens to men in cities but we conspire together in folly rather than in righteousness? Rather than exercising ingenuity and well-doing, what man does in his cities is waste his creativity and evil-doing. Man has left God out of his plans, and the consequence of that, in going to make a name for himself in the great cities that man has built, God has multiplied man's disappointments because we've left God out of the picture. And so God has filled man's labor with futility. But this city, the New Jerusalem, is a new city. And this city is the intended destiny of mankind. Here is civilization at its highest. You've never lived like you'll live in this city. Here God's initial charge to man to subdue the earth will be fulfilled. There have been many great cities through the ages, through the centuries. But this is the holy city. That's what makes it different. It's the holy city. It's the New Jerusalem. It's the city that has foundations. I love that image that it's a city with foundations. You know, John wasn't the first to see the city that's really built on solid ground. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims here. Those who say such things, the writer of Hebrews says, make it clear that they're seeking a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country that they went out from, they would have had opportunity as to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God because He's prepared a city for them. Hebrews 11, 13 through 16. Abraham lived in the center of civilization in his day when he lived in Ur of the Chaldees, but he didn't stay there because he believed that God had prepared a city for him and for all those that would be his descendants by faith. He went out looking for the city whose architect and builder is God. Moses lived in a great city, in a great culture when he was in Egypt, and might have stayed there as an emperor, but he left that and decided to suffer reproach because he regarded the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking for reward. Hebrews 11, verse 26. Listen to what happened to some of our people who were looking for the city that has foundations. Now, these are our folks. Some of them were stoned. I mean, they were slain with rocks. They were pelted with rocks to their death. Some of them were sawn in two. Some of our brethren were tempted, were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins. They were destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. They wandered in deserts and caves and mountains and holes in the ground. Why would people do that kind of thing, do you reckon? Why would somebody give, as the tradition says Isaiah did, why would they give their body to be sawn in half, sawn asunder? Why would somebody, if they could live in a house, why would they choose to live in a hole in the ground or in a cave? Why would you choose that kind of life? To be destitute and to wander in the wilderness? Why would you decide to do that? Well, Hebrews tells us because they believed that God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. They were a people who were looking for a city that has foundations. And I want you to see that what John is showing us in this picture of God's city, just how real this city is. Sometimes I'm afraid that we think of heaven as something that's a bit lighter than air. That it's a place where you can kind of stick your hands through the walls, and it sort of floats in the clouds. And it's got sort of gossamer walls. It's not really something solid. It's really something that's a bit more cloudy and hazy, rather than being something that is real. I want you to see that what John describes here is a place that is real. In fact, if there is a concept that we need to have of heaven, it's something that is more real than what we enjoy here. something more substantial than your present home, something more solid than this building, something more vibrant even than the beauty of the fall color that we see around us. I mean, something that is really, that is more real than anything that you've ever sensed before. And so listen to how he communicates to us how real it is. If the dimensions were literal, the city would be 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles deep, or 2,250,000 square miles, and set on a mountaintop that is 1,500 miles high. Now, here's the comparison to help us get our bearings. This is a city that is set on a hill over 270 times higher than Mount Everest. I mean, bigger than it. 270 times higher than Everest, and covering 8.5 times more territory than the whole state of Texas. That's how wide and deep the city is. And with walls that are 72 yards, 3/4 of a football field, the walls are that high, we're told here. Now, this is not, though, a state. It's not a continent, even. This is a city that is that big, that is that huge. And in this city, the most precious goods are common. Paving stones are made of gold. All the streets are cobble of gold. The foundations are not poured here. They're not dug. They're hewn out of diamonds and gems and precious stones of every color. Red sardius, yellow topaz, emerald green, sapphire blue, amethyst purple. There are a dozen total. The city of God is a city, then, and it's built on a rainbow of color. All of these precious gems. And as you see it from a distance, you see all of them in the light of that city. Isn't it fitting that the foundations should remind us of the faithfulness of God? This rainbow, this city built on a rainbow. And when you walk through the gates of the city, you look at each gate, and each one is fashioned of a single pearl. And you look at the gatekeepers there. You greet them as you walk into the city, and they're not men, they're angels that keep watch. There's a river that flows through the city, and it's found in every street. You walk down the street of gold, and there is kind of an aqueduct that runs down the middle of the street. And you can drink, you can slake your thirst there and drink of the water of life that flows from the throne of God. And on the bank of the river that flows down the middle of every street is a tree that grows. And not just any kind of tree, it's the tree of life that bears fruit every month of the year. And not only is the fruit edible every month of the year, but the leaves also have healing potential. They're there for the healing of the nations. Put all of that together, the streets and the gates and the foundations and the gatekeepers and the tree and the water. And what we have is a city where there are eternal pathways. Streets made of gold, they don't corrupt. They never wear out. What you have here are real foundations, gemstones that show us a city built on a rainbow. Here you have real access, gates of pearl. Here you have real security where angels keep watch. Here you have real nourishment when you eat of the tree of life. Here you have real refreshment where you drink of the water of life. When you have real paths and real foundations and real access and real security and real nourishment and real refreshment, I want you to see, folks, that what we have in this city is the ultimate of all realities. That's why I say that this is the fiction. That is the fact. This is the thing that's passing away. That is the thing that is real and that is substantial, that is eternal. This is the ultimate of all realities, this city is. Here is real life. And here is real life forever. And don't you know that if the most precious commodities are common here, so that even building materials are made of gold, then won't precious deeds be just as common? What city have you ever heard of where love is the rule? What city? Is it Boston? Is it D.C.? Is it New York, where kindness is the norm? It will be in this city. Will not service in the city be habitual, and won't truth be on every tongue? Won't it be that nobody lies in the city? We're told that for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Everything that makes a city into a misery is gone, is vanquished from this city. You see, the city of God surely will be a city not just noted for the absence of these vices that we've just named from chapter 21 and verse 8, but also for the abundance of virtue that's present. And could I say, and listen very carefully, could I say that if you're not practiced in virtue, I mean, if you really don't want to be a good person, if holiness is not your habit, or if you're not trying to be a person that's fit to live with God, if love is not your motivation, if you don't really want what's best for people, if truth is not characteristic of your thoughts and your speech, if you don't love to serve, if those aren't the kinds of things that you like, then can I say to you that you'll not like this city very much? Because in the city of God, not only are the streets gold, but so are the hearts of the people. I mean, they want the same virtue of the one that sits on the throne. It's not that they're a perfect people. They have been perfected by having experienced life here and experienced God's grace here and yearn for, long for God's salvation and for God's promise. And the evidence of that is all around. If you look, did you look close at the foundations and at the gates of the city? Did you see that there are names that are etched both on the foundation stones and on the gates of this city as you come in? You know, there are from the times of John, who wrote this book, and of the early apostles, there are Roman roads still in existence from their times. The Appian Way, you can go and see that if you travel to the eastern parts of the world, that connected the east to Rome. You can go and visit that. You can go to Athens, and you can go to Egypt, and you can go to Rome. And there are many Greek and Roman structures, monuments and theaters and temples and palaces and statues and friezes that are still in existence even from 2,000 years ago and even more. And many of those bear the likenesses and the names of many notable persons. But you can search all of Athens, Greece, if you want. And you can search all of the pyramids of Egypt. And you can go through all of the ruins of Rome. And you can look all over Alexandria and other kinds of ancient cities. And not one city and not one statue and not one monument bears the name of Peter or Andrew or James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James, Bless, Simon, Thaddeus, or Matthias. But every one of those men, their name is etched into the foundation stones of the city of God. God has remembered every one of them. And they're not just those names, but they're also names that are on the gates. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Joseph, and Benjamin. Only one of those brothers ever rose to greatness. Joseph became the second in command in Egypt. He was Pharaoh's prime minister. But so far, we've discovered no sphinx in Egypt that bears the likeness of Joseph. We don't know of any pyramid that houses his treasure or his mummified corpse. His body was taken back to Canaan. There are no hieroglyphics that record the account of how he saved Egypt from starvation or how he forgave his brothers for selling them into slavery. But in the city of God, in this heavenly city, not only does Joseph, but all of his prodigal brothers, every single one of them, have a gate named after them in the city of God, and they've all been etched into the pearl there by the finger of God. All the names on the foundations and on the gates of the city are the names, every single one of them, they're the names of a bunch of sinners. Men that were not famous, men that were not grand, men that are all sinners. But every one of them is the name of an imperfect man who sought God's perfect foundations. You see, this is a city for sinners like us, but redeemed sinners. And those who walk on these foundation stones and those who enter these gates, won't they draw courage and strength from the names that are written there? But even more than the name on the city, on the foundation stones and on the gates, even more celebration will be derived from the name that's etched on the citizens. Chapter 22, verse 4 says, "They shall see His face, and His name shall be on their foreheads." What do you reckon that'll look like? His name on their foreheads. What will it be? Some sort of tattoo? Will it be some sort of brand? I rather think more of some kind of birthmark, perhaps, because these will be the people that have been born again into the family of God. So that's why they wear His name, because they're His family. They're His people. We wear His name because we're a part of His family. And so everybody in the city wears the name of God. And I imagine that that'll change the way people look. I imagine that that'll change the way that people behave. How much trouble had you gotten into in this world because you forgot who you were? You ever have trouble with that? You get with a group of people and they're going somewhere or they're doing something or they're saying something. You get wrapped up in the conversation and all of a sudden you forget that you're heaven bound. You forget that you're a Christian. You forget what you represent. And suddenly you start talking like folks here rather than talking like folks there. Suddenly you start acting not like somebody that is a disciple of the Lord, but you start acting like somebody that is here. And how many times do we find we feel the pressure of the here and now and of the company here and forget who we are? You see, that doesn't happen in this city. It doesn't happen that somebody feels like they don't fit in some way. It feels like that there's not a place for them, and so they become to try to become something that they're not. Or try to fit in a place where they shouldn't be trying to fit in. You see, in the city of God, there is no pretense. There is no hypocrisy. There is no effort to try to show off or to try to mix with people that you ought not to mix with. You see, in the city of God, everybody is a part there. Everybody knows that they belong. Everybody knows because they wear His name, and they wear His name in a conspicuous place on their very forehead. That everybody here knows that they belong, that they are a child of the King, and that they are a part of this common family. You don't think that'll change the way people act and look? You don't think that'll make everybody smile? You don't think that changes the expression on a man's face? You just watch and see. In the city of God, there are not streets. It's impressive to me that it says that there is a street. There's the street. I don't know how there's 12 gates but one street, but maybe they're all one street because they all come to the same place. Every street comes to the throne of God because every street has the water of life flowing down the midst of it, and every street that water comes from the throne of God. So nobody gets lost in this city. Isn't that remarkable? All you do is walk upstream. You always know where you're going. You just walk upstream and you find your place. You find your place back at the throne. Fellas, take courage. You can go around the city and you don't have to have anyone tell you where to go. All you do is walk upstream and you can find your way back home again. You find your way back to the throne. Nobody gets lost in this city. I love that. Nobody gets lost here. Isn't that great? And the city of God is a city of white. There are no veils. There are no mysteries here. There's no sun and moon, it says. No stars. Because the glory of God and of the Lamb are its light. And in this marvelous light, it is so amazing to me that everything seems transparent. The city and the street are made of pure gold, but we're told that they're pure gold like transparent glass. The wall, too, is jasper, possibly diamond. It's a wall that's crystal clear. The gates are made of pearl, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're not transparent too, but it doesn't matter because they're never closed. They're always open. The river is clear as crystal, and there is no night in the city here. Isn't it remarkable that in the city of God you can see through everything? You can see through the walls. You can see through the buildings. You can see through the street. And there's never any darkness. The city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb, and the nations shall walk by its light. You know, there's so many things that we don't see here, that we can't see through. So many clouds that darken the day that we just can't see through. So many walls and so many barriers that get in front of us, and we don't understand, why is this here? Why is this in my path? Why is this blocking my way? But in this city, every trial, every temptation, every suffering, every chastisement, every reason that escaped us, every sorrow that we couldn't understand, every success that we didn't know why did that come, every disappointment that we can't explain, every misunderstanding, every cloud, every shadow, every worry, every anxiety, everything will be transparent there, you see? There isn't anything in the city that you can't see through. Every truth will be brought to light, every myth will be dispelled, every fiction will be evacuated, everything in the city is clear. And I don't know if we'll see it all at once or if we'll see it bit by bit, but I know one thing we'll see in this city. We will see. Farther along, we'll know all about it. Farther along, we'll understand why. Cheer up, brother. We'll understand it all by and by. And if illumination should bring a tear, God Himself will be a comforter to us, not in prayer anymore, but in person. Because God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. Lots of things absent from the city. Sun and moon are not only not necessary as light bearers, but they're not necessary as markers of time. You don't need a watch. You don't need a calendar in the city. Calendars and watches, they'll all be fossils here. They'll all be antiques. There's no sea in this city. The sea is so unpredictable. It's the source of our weather. So many things scary about the sea. The sea was uninhabitable. Remember we talked about that when we talked about creation, that God didn't say Monday was a good day because the sea had not yet been separated so that man had a place to dwell. And so the sea is unfriendly to man. And it is so interesting to me that while there is no sea in heaven, there are no uninhabitable places there. No place that is unfriendly to man. No place where man can't live. There's all there is in heaven are places for man to move into. And there's plenty of space for it. But when hell is described, it is not just a sea. It is a lake. There is no place friendly. And it is a lake of fire. Two of the worst kinds of unimaginable kinds of deaths are of drowning and a fire. And heaven, hell is both of those. There is nothing friendly about it for man. It was not designed for man. It was designed for the devil and his angels. But the city was designed for us. It was designed for man. It was designed for redeemed sinners. And every place in this city is friendly to man. There's no longer any curse in this city, Revelation 22 and verse 3. It's another thing absent, along with the sea and along with the sun and the moon. Which means that a lot of words are going to have to be redefined when there's no curse here. Words like serve and work and labor, even rest, are going to have to be redefined. Because in the city of God, there'll be service without sweat. There'll be labor without toil. There'll be work without weariness. There'll be occupation without boredom. There'll be rest without restlessness. Everything that turns a job into a chore, that turns a task into a burden, a plan into a worry, an investment into a loss, all of those things will be no more. Thorns and thistles in the city are going to be extinct. And his bondservants shall serve him. Revelation 22 and verse 3. I don't know what your work will be. I don't know what job God will give you. But I know this, that your yoke and my yoke will fit us perfectly because God will be the one that will have fashioned what yoke we bear and what service we have in that city. It will fit our personality. It will fit our talents. It will fit what preparations we've made for that city. And so every act will produce the desired effect and will be motored by the right attitude. And the fruit of our labor will be glorious. and we'll bring it to his throne, and he'll be so pleased, and we'll be so satisfied. Faith and hope will be extinct in the city. We'll talk about faith and hope, but we'll always talk about them in the past tense. Because, you see, we'll see him face to face. And if there is a picture that I love more than any picture, it is that. We will see God face to face. What will he look like? When we see his arm bared as he makes this new creation. When we see his brow furrowed as he gives commands, I make all things new. When we see his compassion when he invites us in, what will that be like? I want to see that. So many things to see about this city, and I hope you'll spend some more time dreaming about it and thinking about it, reflecting on the images that are here. Jennifer taught in, she was a teacher's aide in Texas, and she had a little girl she used to help whenever the school buses would come and collect the kids at the end of the day, a little girl named Sierra, who was a spunky little girl, and she wore glasses, but she only had peripheral vision. She really couldn't see. She was nearly blind, but she had a little bit of peripheral vision. And she wore glasses to help with that. And Jennifer was taking her out to the catch the bus after school one day, and Sierra's shoe was untied. So Jennifer was tying her shoe for her, and Sierra was looking at her sideways through the one eye she had that was good, and using her peripheral vision. And she said to Jennifer, she said, "Miss Jennifer, you wear glasses like I do." She was so excited. And then she asked Jen, "Which eye do you see out of?" And it just broke Jen's heart that Sierra asked that. There are things that little Sierra can't see just because she's not able. But you know what breaks my heart? Is there people that don't see this city not because they can't, but just because they won't. I hope you're not like that. Do you see this city? Surely you do. Do you see the home that God's prepared for us? Doesn't that give you a reason to try? Doesn't it give you a reason to press on? Doesn't it give you a reason to grow? Doesn't it give you a reason to have a lighter step tomorrow because you know where you're headed? Doesn't it give you a reason to want to be committed? Doesn't it give you a reason to pray and to want to read your Bible and to want to grow as a Christian? Doesn't it give you a reason to want to bring someone else with you? There is so much great motivation that comes from reflecting on where we're going. This is a real city. I verily believe that God has prepared a city for us, that we're marching to Zion, that it's just over the hill. We're headed to the city that's builder and maker is God. Won't you come and go with us if you're not headed on that trek? Won't you come to Zion with us? We're marching to Zion, folks. We're headed toward that city where the foundations are remind us of the faithfulness of God. It's a city built on a rainbow. We're headed toward the city where the streets are cobbled in gold. We're headed to the city where the gates are made of pearls. We're headed to the city where the throne of God is and where we'll see His face. Won't you come go with us? Won't you come go with us to that city? Won't you come with us as together we stand and as we sing?